Salon at 615 presents best-selling authors free to the public through a unique partnership between Nashville Public Library, Humanities Tennessee, Parnassus Books, and the Nashville Public Library Foundation. This Salon at 615 was recorded live at Hume Fog.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you, Mayor Dean, for that warm welcome. Okay, well, the other part of who played with us is equally impressive. It was Stephen King. And I was the one with the whip who got to whip Stephen King at the end of my song, "These Boots Are Made for Walking." So I think that's one of my best credentials for being here. I got a book after 8 years. And I have to say that the best part about finishing a book is that no one asks you anymore when you're going to finish the book. The worst thing is that people ask you every interview, why did it take you so long to finish the book? I was actually working during that period, the whole 8 years, but on two books. And the first book took 5 years. The other things that I did then, I wrote libretto for an opera, as Mayor Dean was saying, and I also built an accessible house from the ground up, and I also launched the career of a French cabaret singer. All the things you do when you don't want to write a book. I did want to write this book, actually, but, you know, life just intervened, and I was struggling with this book. But when I do write, I always surround myself with photos, and they're on my desk, and they're by my computer. And the photos are all special people to me, friends, family, pets. You do not want to be part of those photos because all these people are no longer here. They're dead. But they inspire me because they make me remember that part of my meaning in life is to think deeply, to feel deeply, to remember as much as I can, and to know what is important in life. So I look at these people as I write, and part of it is also to ask myself the question, who am I? Who was I when I came into this world? How was I influenced by my parents or my circumstances, by accidents, by illness, by all kinds of things to make me who I am today? How did I change or how did I not change? One of the photos, there are two very special photos, and one of them is this woman here. That's my mother. At about age, I would say 17, 18, just before she got married, she's beautiful, as you can see, and beauty got her into trouble. What I mean by that is she was so beautiful, she could get away with a lot of things, but she also was pursued by the most eligible bachelor on this island where she lived off of Shanghai, Chongqingdao. And she was living with the richest family on the island, and he was from the second richest, from a scholar's family, although scholar in a past tense kind of way, but they still had the title of scholar family. And she was married. Somebody suggested they marry, and she actually married him. But it turned out that he was not a good husband. He was unfaithful from the day before the wedding and had different women all the time, was also a gambler and a liar, all kinds of things. You name it. If you could think of the worst character in the world for a husband, that would be her husband there. She was a woman full of passion and anger, and at one point when she tried to leave her husband, she was thrown in jail. She was also given to rages in which she would try to kill herself. At one point, she also met a man she fell in love with, and that man would be my father. She felt that they were destined to be together, and he ended up having to leave for the United States in 1947, where he had a scholarship to go to MIT. He ended up changing and going to Berkeley Baptist Divinity School, but in any case, he had a student visa. She, meanwhile, was trying to extricate herself from this marriage. As I said, she was in jail. She came out, and eventually she was able to get a visa herself. And this visa, it was a student visa, and it said she was going to take graduate studies in American literature. Now, you have to understand, this is a woman whose English was not understandable to most of my friends, and here she was going to go study American literature. I never saw her crack open a novel until she cracked open mine. I was her American literature. But she got this visa, and she was finally able to leave. Her husband would not let her have the kids, and eventually she left China, left Shanghai for the United States, and left behind three daughters. I find that very troubling, of course, as anyone would, and I tried to think of the reasons why she would have done that, that she must have thought she could come back and get them, or that they would be, you know, she could send for them, and she didn't know that the U.S. and China would cut off relations and she wouldn't be able to see them for 30 years. I actually didn't know that she had three daughters until I was about 14 or 15 or so. And it seemed to me, she told me when we were in the middle of the big argument, I would say I was not beautiful. She told me once, I didn't have any boyfriends. No guy ever asked me out, and I thought, well, maybe just to Americans I'm ugly. And so I asked her one day if I was, you know, was I beautiful to a Chinese person? And she looked at me and she said, no, you're not beautiful. She said, maybe average. And I was wounded, of course, but she was trying to say to me, beauty is not good. It'll wear off, and you should want to count on being smart than beautiful. And she said, beauty got me in trouble. And I thought, I don't care. I want to get in trouble. I'd rather be beautiful. But I managed to get in trouble without beauty. So you don't have to be beautiful. I used to worry about that. But you can see, you know, it was true when she told me I wasn't beautiful. You look at my mother, you look at me. By the way, I have no problem. You don't have to tell me later on that I'm not ugly and things like that. I have no problem with my self-esteem there. I'm actually very, very glad that my mother was not somebody who made me think that I could have any boy in the world just because I was, you know, some cute thing. I'm very happy that she emphasized to me that it was more important to be independent. And in fact, during a time before, you know, the idea of, quote, women's liberation was, you know, hitting the, you know, our consciousness at the time, my mother would say, you need to be independent. You need to have your own job, preferably being a brain surgeon and concert pianist on the side, but you need to have your own job so that at any moment you would be able to, if you decided to get married, and you didn't really have to get married, but if you decided to get married, that you should be prepared to leave at any moment. You don't have to wait, you don't have to think about your finances, you don't have to ask your husband for any money to leave, you just can leave. I thought she was so negative. I didn't know anything about her past marriage. I just thought, wow, you know, I would never want to think that way, that my marriage was doomed right from the beginning. She also had very very good birth control advice. She worried that I would also, you know, fall into a trap of having a husband who didn't appreciate me, having babies. So she said, here's what she said to me when I was about 11. Don't let a boy kiss you, because if you do, maybe you can't stop. Then you're going to have a baby. And then you're going to be so ashamed, you're going to put the baby in the garbage can. Then the police are going to come take you to jail rest of your life. You want to kiss a boy? You might as well kill yourself right now. You know, okay, kids, you know, don't try this at home. Actually, you know, my mother, she said these things, but I didn't know what she was talking about. All I could think of, what was so good, you couldn't stop. You know, that was the message, right? That was the message. Okay. So that was, you know, I had all these very oblique warnings from her, and I didn't know what they were about. So this is the man she fell in love with, and around the time that she left Shanghai, came to the United States, married him. I recently found about a year or two ago that she never got divorced from the other man, so she had two husbands. And this was the one of her daughters, Jindo, who I just saw last week in Milwaukee. She had a big lunch for us. She comes and stays with us at least once a year for 10 days, and all she does is cook three times a day. She's like my mother. She just cooks all the time. This is a daughter who was left behind, and she was sent to the countryside during the Cultural Revolution, had to work in the rice fields, and every day she said the worst part was picking leeches off her legs. This was a girl who had to lie on a plank as her bed in a shed with a bunch of other people, and when it rained, as it did last night here in Nashville, the water would go streaming through the shed and underneath her plank of wood, and she was afraid she'd fall in when she was asleep and drown. Meanwhile, you know, I was this teenage girl who was in, you know, not being allowed to kiss, who was living in a pink and white bedroom, pink and white bedspread, and pink and white drawers, and very unhappy about everything, including the fact that I wasn't beautiful. My sister, when I finally learned about these sisters, my mother showed me a photo, and I was crushed, because first it was one shock after the other, knowing she'd been married before. My father was a Baptist minister in addition to being an engineer, and so that was very shocking. My mother had had another husband. Then there were these three daughters, and that made me afraid, because if she could just let go of them, she could let go of me. And while that had seemed like a great thing that she might do one day, you know, I was not getting along, it scared me at the time when I found out she had these daughters. And then the other thing is that her daughters were beautiful, and they spoke Chinese, and they were good, and they were the daughters she wished that she had instead of me. At least that's what I thought in my mind. So there was another photo that I have on my desk, and this is the one that really inspires me. It's my grandmother, and beauty got her in trouble as well. There was a myth about her that she was, or a story, the family story is that she was a beautiful, devoted daughter who was quiet and traditional, very old-fashioned, a stay-at-home kind of woman and mother to two. She, as you can see, this was my favorite photo. She's so beautiful here. She looks so serene. She has on the headband with pearls in it, and it makes that V at the top of her forehead. You see the tight jacket, the collar that goes to just below her earlobe. She has a fitted sleeve. It's not the wide sleeve, as was more typical, that came, you know, to the wrist. This one stopped just below the elbow, and there was white lining showing, matching bracelets, tight pants. She's in a photo studio with pots of flowers around, and I'd look at this photo often, and I would be thinking about what she was thinking at the time. Was she dreaming of her future, a future with a husband? I found out later that she had married late, relatively late in life, 24. She had been married to a scholar who I found out later was unemployed for most of the time that they were married. She was the first wife to this scholar. Actually, I found out later she was the second wife, in other words, a concubine. She had two children, my mother and my uncle, who was a year and a half older. In 1919, during the third wave of the Spanish flu, he died. Her husband died. He had just gotten his first job, but when he came back to get his wife and kids, he died suddenly. She remained a widow for a while, living with her brother, and when she was about 35 or 36, a rich man saw her and asked somebody he knew, her half-sister, if she would invite him to play mahjong at his place on an island. He lived in Shanghai and on an island. And so she brought my grandmother over there, and you know, they spent the night. Of course, there are no taxis you could take back at the end of a game of mahjong. And in the middle of the night, the half-sister got up, and the rich man took her place. And there were two stories about what happened. He came in, put a knife to her throat, and said, "If you don't marry me, I'll kill you." The second one is he put a knife to his throat, said, "If you don't marry me, I'll kill myself." Whatever happened, she ended up marrying him as the fourth wife. She became pregnant, and she struck a deal with him that if she gave him a son, he would buy her a house in Shanghai. She often complained to my mother that the island was boring, really boring. My relatives also said, you know, she was quiet. She was the fourth wife. But I heard from other relatives just recently when I was researching this book that she was actually the favorite at age 36. And there were other wives. Eventually there were seven. But she was the favorite and the oldest. When she didn't get that promised house, she took an overdose of opium. And my mother watched her die over the next 3 days. When she did die, my mother, the 9-year-old girl, wanted to fly to heaven with her. And she said they had to put chains on her ankles. I don't know whether it was real chains or metaphorically, but she said so she wouldn't take off. But as a result of that, I think that my mother, that was the reason my mother was suicidal all her life. Anytime she was angry, she would threaten to kill herself. And she tried on a number of occasions enough so that we had to take her seriously whenever she threatened to kill herself. Essentially, my grandmother abandoned my mother. Abandoned her. And it made me wonder if that was the reason why my mother felt that mothers just abandon their daughters. This is what happens. So this grandmother of mine was always an inspiration to me. She was my muse in the sense that her life gave me a need, an urgency to find a voice for her, what she might have been able to say. And I found out also recently that she was not quiet. She was actually very opinionated, and she got angry. And a relative who lived on the island and had lived in that house told me that years later she'd hear stories, and it went like this. She had strong opinions, and if you did not follow her opinions, you got scared. So she was powerful, not quiet. Anyway, this grandmother, my grandmother, I call her the ghost of my imagination, metaphorically at times, but also I often have felt she was in the room with me or handing me gifts when I least expected it. My mother, she also, there were so many things in the books that I've written, especially the first one, which is the only book she ever read of mine. She said, "How did you know this? How do you know that?" I had heard so many different versions of our family history, and I put down what emotionally made the most sense to me, which turned out to be the true story. But my mother would read that, and she'd say, "Oh, you know, my mother told you this, you know, right?" And I, you know, no. And my mother, actually, she's always believed that I could talk to ghosts, that I would see ghosts. Or sometimes she believed I was the reincarnation of her mother, or someone who she had wronged in a past life, she said, because I was there to punish her. She would come into my room, my mother, and she'd go up to my computer after I wrote the first book and say, "Hello, are you there?" And sometimes I heard, "Hello, I'm here." The way it happened was this. When I would be writing, I'd think about information that I would need One time I was writing a story and I needed to know more about the Taiping Rebellion and to find out if there were actually Hakka people who lived there. And this was such a silly little thing. It had to do with the fact that I had eaten at a Hakka restaurant the night before, and I wondered if I could write off my dinner, calling it research, if only I could, you know, say there were Hakka in this story and then be able to point to that. So right about that time, the doorbell rang, you know, and I'm trying to think of what I need. And I went, and there was a FedEx person there with a package, and I took it back. I opened it. It was the galley copy of Jonathan Spence's new book, Modern History of China. And I thought, wow, oh, that's handy. I opened it up. The first page, I just open it like this. The first page I look at, it's about the Taiping Rebellion, and it talks about the Hakka. And then, in fact, the person I wanted to write about was a Hakka. So I thought, wow, this is really interesting. I've had a number of those happen during the writing of the book, and it almost seemed like it would propel me forward. I had another one where I was writing about the excavation of Peking Man, and I was wondering about, there were two teams, the Westerners and the Chinese, and I was wanting to know more about the Chinese archaeologists who were there when they excavated Peking Man in 1929. By the way, it was actually Peking Woman. This little piece of skull cap that they found was a woman. So I don't know why that hasn't been corrected over these last million years, but it was a woman. When I was working on that, I got a call, and it was somebody saying, you know, would you come at the last minute? We're having a little reception for a bunch of Chinese archaeologists. And I thought, wow, this is so coincidental. And it was at my favorite Chinese restaurant. So I said, sure. We got there, and there were archaeologists there, but they were actually honoring one very special archaeologist. And it was the man, the archaeologist, who had led the Chinese team during the excavation of Peking Man. He was an ancient man by then, but that was who it was. A number of things like this happen when I write a book over and over and over again. And I have at times said to myself, it's just coincidence, that when you are focused on something, all the things in the world come through and filter through this colander of focus that you have, and then what remains is only the things that are significant, and that makes it seem like it's coincidence. But these things were so specific. I mean, come on, the archaeologist who was actually there. After a while, you know, I remember one time I kept having these things happen over and over and over again, and I heard this voice say, "How many do we have to do before you believe?" You know, and you know, okay, serendipity. So I have really, really appreciated what my grandmother has done for me. When I was having trouble with this book, you know, I just wished that she would come and give me more of this serendipity. And, you know, I was getting a little lost with the story. Well, one day I went to see an exhibit on Shanghai at the Asian Art Museum in San Francisco. And there was an illustration of courtesans around the turn of the century. And I learned from the docent there that courtesans were the most independent class of women during that period, more independent than wives. They had a lot of freedom. Get up when they wanted, eat what they wanted, wear what they wanted, design their own clothes, ride around in carriages during the day and show off. They were like pop stars. They were like the Lady Gagas of their time. Very much admired, especially by young girls, schoolgirls, who would nearly faint at the sight of them. And they also said, the docent said, they were courtesans were very influential in bringing Western culture to Shanghai. They had Western furniture, they had a pool table, a spittoon, their clothing had influences that were Western. They went to Western photo studios to have their picture taken. And so I thought, these are strong women and, you know, had an important role to play in Chinese history. So I decided I would include you know, maybe one minor character who was a courtesan. I bought a book, and I was looking through it, a book on Shanghai and courtesan culture, and I got to this picture. This photo, there were 10 women, and 5 of them were wearing these clothes, which, if you can see, were identical to what my grandmother was wearing. The same headband, the tight jacket, the shorter sleeves with the white lining. And it was so stunning to me when I read that these were courtesans. It was about the same year that my grandmother's photo was taken. So, you know, naturally I think, well, this certainly was a popular fashion. And then I read that these details were actually specific to courtesans, that they had innovated this idea, for example, the tighter sleeve, that, you know, shorter sleeve with the white lining. Naturally, I was puzzled. You know, what could be the reasons why she'd done it? Was it as a lark? Did she put on the costume just as I did? You know, for the last 20 years, I've been playing in this rock band called the Rock Bottom Remainders, the one that played with Bruce Springsteen, or rather, he played with us. And I played this role. You know, people asked me, what do I play? And the joke was that Dave Barry would say that I was the lead rhythm dominatrix. And I wore a certain outfit, and I said to myself, just she wore a costume, I wore a costume. God forbid if 100 years from now somebody looked at those 20 years of photos with me in my police cap and my thigh-high boots and my whip and said, oh, she was a dominatrix, and here's the proof. So I had, you know, I was trying to come up with the reasons why it could be something else. I contacted a number of academicians on the subject of courtesan culture in Shanghai, the early 20th century. And one of the things that they said, apart from all the clothes and everything, was the fact that it was taken in a Western photo studio, that more than anything was significant. They also said, however, you could never say for sure that she had been. There could be many reasons, and it would be very perilous to say that somebody, living or dead, had been in this profession. There were a number of these. You know, if it had been just one photo, I would just say, well, it obviously was a lark. I found these others, photos that were always there, but I had never looked at carefully, and certainly not in this light. They were the size of a postage stamp, and I got out a magnifying glass, and I saw what, now with new eyes, you know, the pose, the quality, the kind of pose she had, the very casual hand over hip, hand on hip, that radical hairstyle, which I think is a hairstyle that you'd find, you know, modern even today. You know, it's sort of almost, you know, clipping one side of her eye, a sheath of hair. And if you look carefully, there's modern touches. There's Western fringe at the bottom, and Western shoes, those matching bracelets, the painted backdrop, which is typical of a Western photo studio. As I said, though, I want to make, you know, don't want to make any rash judgments here, because this person here is actually a very respected, quiet, traditional fiction writer. I will actually be wearing those clothes this next, on the 23rd, when we're in Miami, reprising our act, our shameful act we've been doing for the last 20 years. But let me emphasize that it's been for charity. I've subjected myself to this, risked my reputation to raise money for literacy programs benefiting children. This was a, you know, I found these other photos, and again, you know, the poses were so shocking now. The, you know, the casual look there, and a look of, I didn't know whether it was strength or disdain or power or whatever it was, but it certainly was not old-fashioned. And I was glad, whatever her circumstances had been, suddenly she leapt out, no longer the victim, but somebody who had strength and energy. I was so obsessed. I started to research more about courtesans, but with some trepidation because, as I said, my grandmother was my muse, my the purveyor of serendipity. And I thought, you know, this family myth had been there all along. Was she happy with it? What if, you know, if I said she had been a courtesan, would she get mad and no longer bring me any serendipity? And maybe she would instead, you know, blow up my hard disk drive or, you know, all kinds of things. So I'm not kidding. I really worried about my computer, that she would let me know somehow that this was not a story I should pursue. But eventually, I wondered, you know, why did I come across this photo? Why were other things? Now, I started getting other information, other coincidences, piecing together other information that made sense. And so I very cautiously proceeded. I decided to write a story about courtesans. I'll tell you just very quickly a little bit about the courtesan world, also called the flower world. There was a continuum in the sex trade. Courtesans, first-class courtesans, were at the top. They were actually courted. Suitors would come. These people, it was like the Playboy Mansion or something. They would come. They would give them gifts, and the men would socialize with other men. And eventually, the courtesan would be the one who chose which of these suitors would get her intimate favors. There were a lot of records, stories of men who claimed they were fleeced by courtesans because they had given gifts for a very long time along with others. And she, the courtesan, always ended up picking the cute guy, the handsome one, and they felt fleeced. That was, by the way, a really bad way to, that was a way to ruin your reputation by, you know, not honoring the fact that people are courting you in a certain way. Courtesans then did not automatically have sex with their customers. They were entertainers. That difference between an entertainer and somebody in the sex trade sort of disappeared over time as there was a greater influx of people into Shanghai and competition in that world. But for a while, you know, you were lucky if you had been kidnapped, if you were dragged into this, or your mother had been in the world of flowers. You were lucky if you had been cast into the world of flowers in a first-class courtesan house. There were also second-class courtesan houses, and there, their expectation was for sex after a shorter period of courtship. There were women who came upon hard times. Maybe their husbands had died or gambled away all their money, and they might take in a client every now and then to their private rooms. There were streetwalkers, and then there were sex slaves, young girls who were kidnapped and had a brutal life. So there was a time in Shanghai where one out of every 100 women was in the trade somehow. And there were foreigners as well who, the Americans were in these boats in the harbor. I also did a look into the history of Shanghai, and that's because of a personal family interest. I wanted to know more about the overthrow of the Qing Dynasty because my grandfather, I learned, had somehow been involved with a number of the other students who worked very hard at one of the rebellions to overthrow the Qing Dynasty. I wanted to know about the pandemic because, as I mentioned already, he died during the Spanish influenza. I wanted to know about foreign trade in Shanghai, which just phenomenally grew at a phenomenal rate during the turn of the century because the foreigners were coming in from everywhere and they were putting businesses together. Shanghai was a very, very cosmopolitan international city. You know, you had lighted glass dance floors. You had really gorgeous cars and mink coats and glamour and movie stars, gangsters, all of that. The women were, you know, movie stars that you have to imagine Shanghai was no backwater. This was one of the most sophisticated cities out there. And I wanted to know that world. There was another world that was that was different, of course, the rest of China and place the people who were poor in China. But for a certain level of people, especially those in what was called the international settlement, life was a dream. The international settlement is where the Americans and the British, the Canadians, the Australians, and others lived as if they were in their own country. They had their own laws. There were Chinese people who lived there, but they did not socialize with them. And the courtesan houses were located in the international settlement because they were not subject to the same laws of prostitution as the rest of Shanghai. So I did a lot, and we had two family homes that were in the international settlement. I began a new novel. I got rid of that first novel I'd been having such a hard time with, 200 pages gone, and I started this new one. All my novels seem to be about mothers and daughters, and it's really that that's not that I intend to write about mothers and daughters. It has more to do with my obsession about a question I mentioned a while ago, which is, who are we? We come in the world with a certain birthright. We have changes and influences happen to us. We make decisions, or somebody makes them for us. We make mistakes. And how does that all figure into who we become? I think that so much of who we become has to do with how we handle hardships, how we deal with other people. And that's really what I've been writing about all the time. It just so happens, however, that when you think about influences, mothers are often the greatest of influences, both good and crazy. My mother was a huge influence. And she had ideas I didn't understand because I didn't know her life, the life that she came from. And she was also just such a wise, brilliant, protective mother. So very protective. So anyway, that was the story that I wanted to write. And to do that, I chose a mother and a daughter, a mother who's quite different from my others. She's an American, and she's from San Francisco. And as a teenager, she falls in love. She moves to Shanghai to follow a man she loves. And her American sense of ingenuity and American destiny jam right into Chinese tradition and fate. And she thinks she can move this, and she finds she has to do something else to survive in her new country. She ends up starting a... This all happens in the beginning of the book, so I don't think I'm telling you. I'm not blowing it. I'm blowing it now, but the minute you read the first page, this is what you'll find out. That the mother, she's an American, and she runs a social club for Western men and a courtesan house for Chinese men. And they meet in the middle, and it is to have the connections she has. You know, Mr. Wu, I want you to meet Mr. Smith. He has a company that does such and such, and you have an interest in doing this and this. And what they did, it was like a way to put together companies, foreign trade. Both sides of my family were in foreign trade, and I just know that it was an impact on many, many people in Shanghai during that time. So anyway, mother runs that. Her daughter she starts off in the book saying, at the age of 7, I knew exactly who I was. Well, she didn't. That's bravado. She didn't know who she was. And it takes a while for her to learn, and you feel her ambiguity, her anxiety, actually, when she wonders if she's this or that, or what was her mother really saying? Why did her mother seem to pay more attention to this person and not to her? Is she really loved? And she has all these questions that continue to plague her as she goes through a number of hardships and changes, complete changes in her circumstances. I wanted to capture, in other words, a number of things that have happened in our family, the idea that your life can change just like that, and you can go from being an honored wife to a concubine, or that you can go from being a wife to a widow, or a daughter to an abandoned daughter. And with all of that, I wanted to find out all the qualities of love, what we expect from each other, from mothers, from lovers, from husbands, from children, from friends. What kind of love and trust and honesty do we expect from people? And when we're betrayed, or when we're abandoned, or when people have lied to us about our circumstances and who we are, what do we forgive? Is there anything we can never forgive? Those are questions I asked of myself, and that I discovered as I was writing the book, thinking that the qualities I have, not all of them attractive, or things I could now see, had been influenced by my mother and my grandmother. I was also very interested in the question of independence, why my mother was so fiercely insistent on my becoming an independent person, that I didn't have to marry, that I didn't have to have children, that no one should say I should ever have to do either of these things. The only thing I had to do was have a job and be able to leave whenever I wanted. I wanted to know more about how we become pragmatic when things are bad, what causes us to give up certain things, to make concessions to ourselves, compromises. What do we do that is necessary? What does pride mean? And so this is the book that I have written, The Valley of Amazement. The valley, that's the valley that I went to for part of this research, a place in the most remote part of China, Guizhou, and which inspired me. I would like to now read four short excerpts that will give you some idea, I hope, of what this place is like. So the first is having to do with Violet. The mother is Lulu, the daughter is Violet. And the first has to do with Violet's sense of identity, or, you know, her uncertain identity. She's growing up in this house with courtesans, and she has learned that her mother has lied about her past, and she has to find her place as a person who might possibly be half Chinese. I no longer spoke Chinese to the cloud beauties or to the servants. I used only pidgin. If they talked to me in Chinese, I pretended I did not understand them. I told them again and again that I was an American. I wanted them to recognize we were not the same. I wanted them to hate me, because this would be proof that I did not belong to their world. And a few of them did come to hate me. Cracked Egg, the gatekeeper, however, laughed at me and said that he had had both Chinese and foreigners treat him worse. He continued to speak to me in Shanghainese, and I had to acknowledge that I understood, because he was the one who told me when Mother had returned, or that she wanted to speak to me, or that she had asked that the carriage be brought around to take us to the new restaurant for lunch. No matter what I did, I feared the stranger father within my blood. Would his character also emerge and make me even more Chinese? And if that came to pass, where would I belong? What would I be allowed to do? Would anyone love a half-hated girl? The second is when Violet sees a painting, and it's a painting that is described several times, because three generations of women see this painting. She has had something terrible happen to her at this point. So hard to talk about the book and not tell you exactly what happened, you know, the suspense of it. So I'll just say something terrible has happened. She's found herself, she's just in a completely different situation that makes her very, very unhappy, and she comes across a painting that had belonged to her mother she never really looked at. I unrolled the smaller painting. The initials LS appeared on the bottom of that one as well. It was a landscape of a valley viewed from the edge of a cliff facing the scene below. The mountain ridges on each side were ragged, and their shadow silhouettes lay on the valley floor. The pendulous clouds were the shade of an old bruise. The upper halves were pink, and the clouds receding in the background were haloed in gold. And at the far end of the valley, an opening between two mountains glowed like the entrance to paradise. It looked like dawn, or was it dusk? I could not tell whether the rain was coming or the sky was clearing, whether it was about arriving there with joy or leaving it with relief. Was the painting meant to depict a feeling of hope, or was it hopelessness? Were you supposed to be standing on the cliff, charged with bravery, or trembling in dread of what awaited you? Or maybe the painting was about the fool who had chased after a dream and was looking at the devil's pot of gold that lay in that glimmering place just beyond reach. The painting reminded me of those illusions that changed as you turned them upside down or sideways, transforming a bearded man into a tree. You could not see the painting both ways at the same time. You had to choose which one it was originally meant to be. How could you know which was right unless you were the one who painted it? I saw that painting actually in Germany, and that was the feeling I had about it. This is, there's an older courtesan who coaches Violet. Now, I know we have students here. There have been some remarks that have been made that this is the first book that I where I have included sex. And at first I was not going to do that because, in part, everybody thinks all my books are autobiographical. And I was afraid they'd read these things and say, oh, you know, that's what she does. And I also, because I had my grandmother in mind as my inspiration, you know, you shouldn't be imagining your grandmother doing certain things. So I was very reluctant, but one of my early, my freelance editor who's looked at all my work since I first started writing, she said, well, you know, they're not playing Chinese checkers in there. You're going to have to say something about what it is they do. So anyway, there is this, and I just, full warning if people don't, you know, I know tender mother-daughter stories, people know that about me, and they just, some people just might not want to see that. So this is where this courtesan advises Violet about some lessons in life. Do you want to wear out your insides by the time you are 16? Of course not. Then learn these lessons well. When you are still a virgin courtesan, you must learn all the arts of enticement and master the balance of anticipation and reticence. Your defloration won't happen until the new year when you turn 15, and I expect you to have many ardent suitors by the time Madam is ready to sell your bud. You might be thinking, what does my attendant old magic gourd know about romance? When I was 19, I was one of the top 10 beauties of Shanghai. And not too many courtesans last until they are 32. So you see, I know more than most. Always remember, little Violet, you are creating a world of romance and illusion. When you play the zither, it should be with the aching of, or joyous companion to your sing-song poem. Sing to your suitor as if no one else is in the room, as if it were fate that brought you two together at this moment, in this place. You cannot simply pluck the silk strings or let memorized words fall from your mouth. You might as well not play at all and just take the sedan directly to a brothel where no one bothers with allusions or preludes. And she gives her tips later, but I'm not going to go into those here. And this is at a certain point when I had said, you know, we all change depending on how we've dealt with a number of things, hardships, disappointments, or joy, or children, or love, and getting older. And at this point, Violet has made a change, and she has decided at one point not to fall in love, which is, of course, an impossible thing when you say, I'm not going to be hurt by not falling in love. These courtesans, by the way, you know, they started their careers when they were in their teens, and it was usually over by the time they were 21, 22. So, they, you know, their emotions, their hormones are that of a teenager, and sometimes they can be very impetuous, you know, and saying, I'm not going to fall in love is not really realistic. But anyway, she does fall in love, and there's a man. She tries to just look at him as another suitor. And his name is Loyalty. He says he does not want her to, he can't be with her all the time, because when he sees her, she creates this yearning in him to be a better person. And so if she's always with him, he'll be satisfied and they won't yearn anymore. So he won't strive to be a better person. So you've heard that, girls, you've heard that before, haven't you? Yeah, I know, yes. Okay, so here's what Violet says when Loyalty says he's going to be her friend all her life. But with each question I asked, he gave me a better answer than I had expected, but it was contained within a worse one, a riddle of hope. He had pledged himself to me for life, yet he did not want to ever be fulfilled by me, and so we had to remain apart. What did he think I would fulfill? Why couldn't I simply fail to fulfill it? What about my yearnings? I felt as if I were running in a labyrinth, chasing after something I could not yet see, and yet I knew was important. I sensed it was just ahead, and then it would go around a corner, and I would be lost. I would have to decide what to do next, where to go, and what I needed to get there, get out of that confusing place. If I stopped running and stood still, I would be accepting that what I had was all I would ever have. And then I would no longer be lost, because there would be nowhere else to go. As time went by, I discovered the stranger I had been running after, my happier self, which all my worries and discontent had chased away. I left behind my yearnings, and I continued on with a sharper mind and clearer eyes, ready to take what was in front of me. Thank you. Thank you. I think we have time to take questions, and I have somebody who will help me monitor questions, and I don't know if we can have the lights up, but if we can't, somebody can. Great, perfect. So maybe somebody can help me choose those who ask the questions and how much time we have. So, first question. I have never been in a place where we say, who wants to ask the first question? Somebody says, I do. No one, no place, never. Adults, you know, high schools, never any place. So anyway, somebody can be. Okay, first. Great. The story behind the picture. You know, no, this is no one I know. And I asked them about this picture, why it was this half face. And apparently they've done research, market research, and that readers do not want a whole face on a book because they want to imagine that they are the character. That's why it's a half face. And you might end up seeing, now that you've noticed this one, you'll see other books with the half face look. But this friend of mine said, he wrote me a note and he said, oh, that's so clever that you made a book jacket that can serve as a mask. And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, well, you put it up. So I did. I put it up. we've been having people who've been taking these pictures and posting them on, you know. If you want to do that, go to my Twitter or my Facebook and post your, they call it a meme, you know, but, you know, post it. Amy Tan, the check mark, Amy Tan, the check mark on both of them. So, yeah. Did you all hear that? Oh, okay. She said she'd read my book, The Opposite of Fate, and so she knows something about my life and that I've been through a lot of hardship. How does writing help, or, you know, how is writing a part of that, how I deal with hardship? Well, when I look back on my life, it's also with a distance of years, and that distance enables me to see a larger part of my life, which gives me a different kind of perspective of where I was. It's very hard to be in a place like Violet, where your life has just changed and you can't see where you're going to go after that. It's like that valley. You've entered the valley. What's beyond that? You don't know. But now I have been through many valleys, and I look back, and I can do so with humor. And what writing does is it enables me to remember it in a different way, remember it with a better understanding of myself and also with the people involved or the situation. Humor is, for me, so much a part of it, being able to look back, and it's not that I have to force the humor, it just is a natural part of that, having seen what things became. I never knew my mother was so funny until I look back on the things that she said, and then moving forward over time, you know, hearing that she'd say things that were hilarious. You know, like the thing about don't kiss a boy. Yeah, it was like, oh, how negative, you know, can she be? Now I look back and I think, that's hilarious, you know, but now I know why she said it, because of what had happened in her life. So writing is also, as I said, one of the meanings of my life, having to do with thinking and feeling as deeply as possible. I think about my life as finite. You know, we all have this different ways in which we think of what we do in our life and the length of it. And I'm not morbid at all about mortality, but I just feel that during that time there's a way that I have to prove that I existed to myself, and that is to feel and feel deeply. Writing, in it facilitates that, because I'm forced to notice, I'm forced to feel, it reminds me of that. And when I go back and I look at journals and other things that I've written, I see I was alive. If I forget it, to me it's as though I've already died. That part of me that lived during that time is gone. And it's a loss of memory completely. But if we continue to remember, then we are living, and our life is continuous that way. So that's the feeling I have when I write. It is that encapsulates the meaning of life, which includes relationships with people and things that I see in nature. I will say that I've often, looking back on life, that I think that a family is—it's like a test of our humanity. You know, you get everything that can make you crazy and that make you so incredibly happy. You know, so if you were to ask me what is the most important thing in the world, it would be family, and it encompasses all of that thinking and feeling as deeply as possible. Yes. Did my mother what? Supportive? Oh, you know, I disappointed her so long ago. When I went to college, I struck out on my own. I fell in love with a boy. I got terrible grades because I wasn't studying. I was being in love. And I flunked calculus. And I decided that instead of being a doctor, I would be an English major. And she was very disappointed, you know, because everybody knows you can't make any money being an English major. So I already disappointed her. But eventually, I ended up being accepted to a doctoral program at UC Berkeley in linguistics. And so I told her I'd get a I'd be a doctor in a different way. But everybody knows you back then you could make no money being a linguist. That people didn't have computer language you were supposed to do things, fancy things with. But by time before I started writing fiction, I was a business writer, and I was what my mother advised. I was independent. I made my own living. I could leave my husband at any moment that I wanted. I didn't, of course. My husband is just, he was the boy I fell in love with at college. He's here in the audience. Where is he? There he is. Yeah. We've been together almost 44 years, if you can believe that. Maybe it was my mother was right. Just the knowledge I could leave at any time made me want to stay, you know. It was always a choice. Anyway, did I answer your question? Okay, all right. Oh, you know, I think of myself as, you know, really pretty much an American, but who has a family history and an unknown one based in China, a lot of unknown parts of it based in China. I love to go back to China, and I go back probably once a year. I go back often enough that sometimes I just go there and all I do are personal services. And by that, I mean pedicure, you know, manicure, you know, hair, eating at a favorite restaurant, you know, hanging out with friends. So I'm comfortable there. And I've gone with my sister to places in China. And I speak nothing but Chinese when I'm with her. I used to not speak any Chinese. And I was very surprised to discover that it was in my head from when I was a little kid that my mother did speak Chinese to me. And I never had to speak back, but it was there. And so when I talk to my sister, after a day or so, I'm just speaking purely Chinese. So that to me is wonderful, and that is about the closest of, you know, when I start feeling a little bit differently. My assumptions and my upbringing, my thoughts about choices and independence are very much rooted in this country, and so I can't say that I am split one way or the other. But I was raised by a very Chinese mother. And so I'm aware of the ways that it's different, especially when I see friends and there's a situation we're in and they react in a certain way, and I think, I never would have done that. And here's an example. When we were in China, I was with somebody who, we were in a tiny little village, and there's no heat or anything. So we're far away from everything. But she was using her cell phone to talk to her husband an hour a day. And she had no special calling plan or anything. You know, I thought, and here we are in China, I thought, I would never do that. I mean, there are a number of times when there's a sense of value or frugality or just things you would do and not do. And I found myself, I would never do that. That's when I think, well, there's that Chinese part in me and that my mother would. I would have found, here's what I would have done. I would have found a very clever way to talk as long as I wanted, but for free, you know, okay. I would use technology, you know, some kind of Chinese-American or Chinese and American ingenuity and engineering and all of that. To do the same thing, but not just, you know, and asking her, well, that's going to cost you about $3,000 when you get home. And she said, yeah, you know. You know, I don't know. I love my husband. I wouldn't call that often. Not for an hour. He doesn't listen to me for an hour in front of me. Why would he listen to me on the phone? So I'm sorry, no, he's very good. I have to tell you, the fact that he is on book tour with me is a testament to how incredible he is. Book tour is the most arduous thing. And for a spouse, one of the most boring things you can do, just checking into the airport, doing this, schlepping luggage, checking out, and not really being able to see a lot of things. So he is, I'm really happy he's here, and I don't force my conversations on him. I'm talking to you, and I hear, every now and then I hear people say, I could listen to you for hours, and I say, Lou, here, see that? He'll say, I'm trying to read the newspaper. And I remind him, they said. Okay, you want to choose the one? I'm not going to. Oh, okay, when I'm not writing or working, and what genre do I enjoy reading? That, and you qualified it in the right way, because often when I'm writing, I cannot read good fiction. I mean, fiction I love, because I fear I will be influenced by the voice. Because I choose books on the quality of the voice and not by subject or genre. It could be really probably any genre, as long as the voice is one I want to listen to. And by voice, I mean it's somebody who is the guide to the universe, not a particular diction, but somebody who has a viewpoint of the world, who tells the story. It's the narrator. And there's a big confusion for some, you know, between the writer and the narrator, but it is a combination. But the writer enters into the narrator and tells a particular story in a particular way, and that is the voice. And so I'm attracted to very strong, particular, unique voices, and because of that, I can't read them when I'm writing. But I'm reading, believe it or not, I love books about dog behavior, ant behavior, bird behavior, cognition, animal cognition, and I can read those whether I'm writing or not. I love them. One's called The Genius of Dogs, and it is about qualities of cognition that dogs have developed during the whole long period that they became domesticated, and what skills they know now. And I'll tell you one thing that's very, very interesting. In this book, The Genius of Dogs, dogs are the only animals that can understand our human communication by gesture. Not all dogs can do this, but you'd have more chances of having a dog go, if you said, Fido, go over there and go, you know, go get the ball. Fido would more likely go there. You say to bonobos that has the DNA closest to us, and you say, you know, Billy, go over there and get the ball, and they're just, you know. I think that is a very interesting thing that developed gestural communication in dogs, and it has something to do with domestication of the dogs. So the other book that I'm reading, I like to read books that take place in different countries, a different perspective. I love Javier Marias, A Heart So White, for example. I am reading a book by a writer named Rabi Alameddine. He's Lebanese-American. And he wrote a book, the last book he wrote was called The Hakawadi. And it's a beautiful book, and it concerns a story that has been told throughout the ages, basically the same story told by many different religions. From Christian through Muslims, and the variations that happened. And it's this storyteller who weaves in different things, and some of them are beautiful and some of them are profane, but you begin to see the causes of a lot of holy wars between just these different emphases and interpretations on this one universal story. He also, the new book is called An Unnecessary Woman, about a translator who translates all the great books that we, you know, a lot of books we love. And this book takes place in Lebanon and also during the war. It has characters in there, many things that are very relevant, I think, to what's happening today in the Middle East. Yet the language is gorgeous, and it's not slap you in the face politics, but it concerns, it's very, at times, fantastical or comical, but it's also very, very serious. So that's a writer whose work I really, really admire. An Unnecessary Woman, and it'll be out in February. It's not out yet. I get to read books before they come out. Free books. I get a lot of free books. So anyway, you've been lovely, a lovely, lovely audience. Thank you so much.